If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams, so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Three great words, free fries Friday, especially when they're used in that exact order. Get a free medium fries with $1 minimum purchase.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Valid one time on Fridays at participating McDonald's through 12/31/24. Excludes tax, must update rewards.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Imagine being tasked with a key role in crucial negotiations, a role that could alter the course of global international relations. But on top of that, you're the only person in the room who can communicate between the two opposing sides, both of which know hardly anything about the other's language, culture, or motivations. Henrietta Harrison's book, The Perils of Interpreting, looks at two interpreters who found themselves in that exact position when they were working on negotiations between the British Empire and China in the late 18th and 19th centuries. The book's recently been shortlisted for the Kundal History Prize, and we've teamed up with them to bring you conversations with all of the nominated authors. So I spoke to Henrietta to find out more. In your new book, The Perils of Interpreting, you follow two interpreters who were at the heart of a pivotal moment in diplomatic relations between China, on the one hand, and the British Empire, on the other, at the end of the 18th century. So can you start us off by introducing us to this story and its central players?
So the two people who are the interpreters are taking part in this big diplomatic embassy. And that embassy is being led by Lord Macartney, and he's the big English ambassador. And the embassy is going to the Qianlong Emperor. Qianlong Emperor is in his 80s. He's ruled China for nearly 50 years. He's incredibly powerful, really magnificent emperor. And this is the first time that Britain and China have that formal contact between the courts, formal diplomatic contact.
So before we talk in more detail about these two interpreters, who are both fascinating figures, let's give our listeners a little bit of context here. So what was happening in China and in Britain at this time?
So this is the period that the Chinese call one of their great periods of history. The Qing Empire had conquer China. They were not Chinese people. They're Manchus. They came down from the north, from the Central Asian steppes. They conquered China in the 17th century. And then their empire continues to expand outwards. It's a very glorious and magnificent period. However, it's also got the seeds of decline, as is so often the case. There are actually underlying financial problems. But at this stage, they're still not visible to anyone, except for the people actually running the state's finances. So that's on the one side. On the other side, we have the British. And obviously, we've had the Age of Exploration. And this is the period of British expansion in India. And one of the things I really wanted to say with my book is that that's important to how Britain and China relate. People have tended to see these two as entirely separate. And indeed, the Chinese were very poorly informed on what was going on in India. They hardly knew the Chinese state about what was happening. But so one of the things I'm really interested in is, why did they not know what they didn't know about India?
So what were some of the key issues on the table in these negotiations? Was it trade? Was it war, religion, cultural exchange?
So the British wanted to expand trade with China. So Britain is importing huge amounts of tea, vast quantities of tea from China, and they want to have exports to China. And the particular thing they want to export is British woolens. But in order to expand their exports, they want to reduce taxes. And the method of this they would like is for them to have an island off the coast of China and to have a resident at the court, an ambassador at the Qing court who could influence events. And that, of course, is very much a similar approach to how they approached India. But it's usually been thought of really differently as Britain trying to set up diplomatic relations with a country that hitherto did not have diplomatic relations with the West.
So I'm intrigued as to the approach of your book, because rather than focusing on the diplomats who were involved in this exchange, you've decided to focus on the interpreters. Why did you do that?
I originally came across this book because I was in the Vatican in the archives of the Propaganda Fide, which is the Congregation for the Evangelization of the Peoples. It's where the Vatican keeps its world archives. And I was reading for another book and I found about all the Chinese Catholic priests who'd worked in Shanxi province. That's my main area of research, North China, over 200 years. And I found this amazing set of letters from this Catholic priest who'd been Chinese Catholic priest, Li Zibiao, or Jacobus Li, who'd been the interpreter for this embassy, describing not only what it was like, but also explaining that he'd added an item of his own to the negotiations as the interpreter. And that was really rather remarkable. He'd put to the Chinese a request for toleration of Catholics, which was not something, obviously, that the 18th century British state was necessarily going to have supported.
And I think that's really at the heart of your book, isn't it? It's this role of interpreter, which is beyond just taking one message and relaying it to somebody else. It's so much more complex than that. So what can you tell us about what it was like to be an interpreter at this time when so few people could communicate between two cultures?
Yes. And so this is really about not like interpreting in Europe where there'd have been multiple people, but about interpreting in Asia, where you might have a situation where you were the only person present who actually understood exactly what was going on. And I think we underestimate the fact that interpreters always have power. I teach in a Chinese department. And if you do that, you understand that when you speak something in one language, there's not an exact equivalent. You're always making changes. And of course, if you're an interpreter, you're doing that on the fly. And this is before recording equipment. These people are just listening to something somebody says and then explaining it.
I wonder if you could give us some examples, because you have some in your book, of how in the context of China and Britain, these messages could be warped, if that's the right way of putting it.
Well, yes. So quite often people have thought about it in terms of mistakes, but I think that's probably not quite right. I think the more I think about it, and the more you understand it, you see that basically you've always got to make choices. So, for example, the Chinese had a word for foreigners, and this is the word yi. And this term yi is a term which has been translated subsequently as barbarian. And when the British found they were being described as barbarian, they were furious. However, that word Yi is used up in North China for the Mongols, who are very much, the Mongols are part of the Qing Empire. They're one of its major peoples there. Their culture is respected. It's widely used. And I think to translate this word Yi as barbarian is to try and fit a set of ideas from the Roman Empire onto China that just don't quite fit. And there's a similar issue with tribute. So the Chinese term gong, which means a gift that is given to someone, usually someone above you. And that got translated into English at the time of the Opium Wars as tribute. And the British said they refused to pay tribute to the Chinese emperor. However, that word does also just mean a gift. And although it has a slight directional tone to it, that it's generally a gift upwards, it's not always a gift upwards. It can sometimes be a presentation by someone downwards. So it's really very complex how you choose to translate this. You're always going to make choices. You can't not make choices. And when Li Zibiao translated, because he was Chinese and what he wanted was a good outcome for the negotiations, he used those relatively positive. So he was translating actually into Latin or Italian. And he used, for example, for foreigner, or barbarian, he used the Latin word externi, which means sort of outsider. He uses quite neutral terms that everybody will be able to accept. Whereas later on, as the British Empire becomes very active in China and people become quite aggressive, they don't want to use those terms. They use these very strong terms, which are very angering. If they want to motivate the British to engage in warfare, they will use these much stronger terms to translate.
So these nuances of language are so important, aren't they?
These are just crucial. So, you know, the Macartney Embassy has always been regarded as a disaster because the British didn't get their island. But that's a bit unfair because the Chinese didn't want to give an island of their territory. You know, you could have regarded it as a quite successful, and Li Zibiao did regard it as quite successful because by the time everybody left, everybody was, it went off quite well. The embassy was quite satisfactory. The British had decided they would come back and they thought they would get more than they'd got the previous time. And it looked like, to him, like the start of diplomatic relations.
So let's talk now in more detail about the two men at the heart of this story. What can you tell us about who Li and another interpreter, who we haven't mentioned yet, I don't think, called Staunton, who they were and how they became interpreters?
Okay, so they're amazing people. I'll start with Li because he's the older one. So Li Zibiao was born in the far northwest of China, up on the Silk Road. So really quite a remote place. But his grandparents probably had converted to the Catholic Church. So there had been Jesuit missionaries very famously going out from Europe in the 17th century and went to China and worked for the emperors, first of the Ming dynasty and then of the new Qing dynasty. And they were out there and people converted to Catholicism, and Li Zibiao's family were part of that. So when he was 12, a Chinese priest came to visit their town, and he said, "Why don't you send your son to study to be a priest?" And he sent this little 11-year-old off to Naples, to where he studied at a special college that the Catholic Church had set up to train Chinese to be Catholic priests and to be missionaries to go back to China. And he spent the next 20 years of his life there. And it was a very, very classy education. It also ran as a kind of posh boarding school for local Neapolitan aristocrats. So Li's best friend was someone called the Duke of Vallimezzano, or at least he was about to be the Duke. Giovanni Maria Borgia, he was going to be the Duke of Vallimezzano. And they were really very close. And actually, Li was still writing to him 20 years after his return to China, saying, "I'll remember how entwined our souls were in youth." So I originally started this project because I found Li Zibiao's correspondence, and I just thought it was amazing to be hearing about a Chinese priest who was traveling around Europe and writing letters about what it was like. This was just amazing. So I really wanted to write a book about him. And then every time I talked about this embassy, the Lord Macartney's embassy, people said, "Oh, but wasn't there a little boy, an English little boy?" And I thought, well, I must actually look at the English little boy too, because there was. So Lord Macartney's secretary was a man called George Leonard Staunton, who came from an Irish Catholic background. And he was a huge enthusiast for the Enlightenment too, and he was bringing his child up as a kind of 18th century project, poor child. So he was going to be a kind of genius in botany and languages. So he had to be able to recognize lots and lots of different kinds of mosses. But he also was made to speak Latin from age 5. So if ever he wanted anything, his father made him say, "Si tibi placet," please, in Latin. And so his father thought that his child was going to be the first to really learn, British person to really learn Chinese. So he had a deep belief in teaching languages by total immersion, which was quite unusual. And he took this little boy on the embassy. And he also made, so there were actually 4 Chinese priests who went on this embassy, Li Zibiao and 3 others. And the embassy found them in Naples and then took them back to China. George Leonard Staunton, the father of the little boy, made sure that they also taught his son Chinese. So his son had lessons, 3 hours a day, Chinese lessons, all the way around the world on the boat, which was a year of travel. And actually, when you're 11, if you have 3 hours a day of lessons in a language, you can get quite good at it. And various of the adults tried, but they couldn't do it. When they got to China, it turned out no one could understand them. But this little boy was really good at languages. He'd been brought up to study very hard all his life. And he plugged away. And when he got to China, it turned out people could understand him. And so he then was also there. But of course, when you're 11, he was between 11 and 12 on this occasion, you're not really going to be a major diplomatic interpreter. So in fact, what happens is Li Zibiao does the diplomatic interpreting for the embassy. And then George Thomas Staunton goes on. I mean, he's present at the meeting with the Qianlong Emperor, and it's the kind of big event of his life. But he then goes on to work for the British East India Company in Canton. He becomes their interpreter, and he ends up making a fortune and becoming an MP.
The status of these interpreters is really interesting, because something you discuss in the book is how, if you were immersed in 2 cultures, how you were never entirely trusted by both. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yes, so this is something that people in translation studies talk a lot about, that the translator is a traitor. In order to really know a language well enough to interpret, you have to be very deeply immersed, and you have to have friends. And this same thing, so I spoke a little about Li Zibiao and Giovanni Maria Borgia, but when George Thomas Staunton arrives in China with the East India Company, he too ends up making friends with local Chinese people. And that's partly because he's been pushed on the East India Company. You really didn't want it. This is a prime job for the directors of the East India Company. They give it to their most incompetent sons, because when you've got this job as what they call a writer in the East in the Canton factory, so in South China, you're going to make money. You get a cut on the trade. And if you stay there, you will become rich. And then they get this little boy who's been pushed on them on the grounds that he knows Chinese. And they're like, well, we don't need anyone who knows Chinese. We have a perfectly good system where the Chinese merchants speak pidgin English, and we're absolutely fine with that. Well, the last thing we need is some English boy who knows Chinese, and taking this money from our family members. And also, he'd had this really weird upbringing where his father was really influenced by Rousseau and never let him speak to another child his own age under the age of 16 without an adult present. He didn't want any bad influences on his child. So, of course, he'd never been to school. He had this very bizarre education. So he was really bad with people. And when he got to China, not only was he really bad with people, poor child, but by this stage he's 17, but he's also, everybody really resents him turning up. So what he actually ends up doing is having friends who are among the young Chinese men working in the factory. And he gives, you know, he tries to become better and better at speaking and translating Chinese, and they help him and he learns from them and he becomes very, very close to them. And those kinds of relationships make people problematic from either side. But you need those kinds of relationships to have this quality of language ability.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Quite often the problem was that the central state decision-making body wasn't necessarily as well as informed as it could have been. And one of the reasons for this is the fear of those people who are in between.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
What were some of the key moments in the careers of Staunton and Lee? Moments where perhaps we can unpick their influence or see that they had a significant impact?
Well, so obviously with Lee, that key moment is the McCartney Embassy, where we can see him smoothing things over with the elegant translations and with a very positive line. And he was always very good with people and keeping everybody on side. And he applied that to the embassy. And what the Chinese was concerned about was that the British might start bombarding. They'd come in this big warship and other well-armed ships, and they were anxious that the British might actually launch an attack, and that didn't happen. I mean, of course, the British said that they weren't going to do that, but equally, as they sailed around the world, they assessed all ports for the possibilities of bombarding them. If we talk about Staunton, the big moments he has an impact are probably in after he's gone back to China in the early 19th century. He's in China from 1799 through to 1817. And in that period, he's learnt interpreting in this same way, all about the spoken language, and he uses this very smooth style, which makes everything acceptable. So when you read Staunton's translations of Chinese officials, they just sound exactly like 18th century English gentlemen. They're all in that kind of world of writing. And the other person who turns up with Staunton about that time in China is someone called Robert Morrison. And he's the first British missionary to China. And he's wanting to translate the Bible. And in order to do that, he wants to start off with a dictionary. And he comes from working class background in Newcastle. His father had been a bootblast maker. He's worked in his father's workshop. And then he becomes inspired to go and be a missionary. And he goes off on this thing with basically no money. And Staunton is his big patron when he gets there, because they're the only two people who are interested. But Morrison, because he wants to translate the Bible, he thinks each word. He thinks with the Bible, you've got to say exactly what's in it. You can't go smoothing it out into something that's acceptable. So he's really obsessed with getting each word absolutely correct. And so he produces translations which make the Chinese sound really strange. Because Chinese, if you translate it into English, does sound odd. It's a different kind of language. And it makes the whole thing sound totally alien, because you have to use lots and lots of different words. A very good example is that up until this time, the Chinese way of talking about the English king was usually to say that country's king. And George Thomas Staunton always translated this, His Majesty King George III. when Robert Morrison turns up, they go over to that country's king. And of course, that country's king sounds really different. But for the Chinese, it wasn't necessarily disrespectful. And obviously, the Chinese letters that Staunton is translating when he translates it, His Majesty King George, he's trying to get across what the Qing officials and what matters to him is what their intent was. What kind of people were they? Are they intending to be aggressive or are they intending to be placatory and to give the British what they want? And he's trying to get that across, whereas Morrison is trying to get across each word. And it doesn't matter if the overall effect is that this is a very strange person being rude to the English king.
That's so interesting, isn't it? In the case of Staunton and Lee, what were some of the key cultural differences when approaching negotiations that they had to kind of move between?
Well, I suppose the big event of this is what this embassy is most famous for, which is the issue of the kowtow. Kowtow was Chinese kowtow, means to get down on your knees and bow your head to the floor. And if you did this, and this is a kind of quite normal greeting between people in China, if you would definitely do it for your parents, but actually friends might get down on their knees to each other. Obviously, it was certainly not something people did in Europe. You know, this is the age of the Dutch and shaking hands and a very different kind of etiquette. The Chinese were famous for requiring ambassadors to do this. So when you met the Chinese emperor, you were supposed to, you got down on your knees and you bowed your head to the ground 9 times. So you did 3 times down, then you kneeled up, and then you get another 3 times, and then you kneel up, and then you do another 3 times. It's a very major ceremony. Historians have said for many years, and this started straight after the embassy, that Lord Macartney didn't get an island, didn't get what the British wanted, because he refused to do this to the Chinese. And actually, this was a big issue before the embassy ever went off. The British knew that, and there were cartoons, Gilray-ed cartoons of Macartney on his knees in front of the Chinese embassy before the embassy ever set off. So we were all really worked up about this. And the Chinese reports always said that Macartney did do it. And for many years, the historian's line was, English sources are bound to be accurate and English people didn't tell lies. Therefore, Macartney correctly said that he didn't kowtow. Therefore, the Chinese are inclined to lie, so we don't believe their sources. But that's a ridiculous attitude because diplomats do lie. It's part of the whole game of diplomatic negotiation. And one of the things I realized when I was doing this research was that the Chinese emperor didn't actually see these people in Beijing. He saw them at his summer palace. And of course, he's not Chinese. He's a Manchu from these steppe peoples. And when he's at his summer palace, which is up in the mountains where he goes hunting in the summer to get away from the heat of Beijing, he can use different kinds of etiquette. And in fact, the Manchus have an etiquette where they go down on one knee and bow and put a hand on the ground. And that, of course, is much closer to what the British did. So Lord Macartney only took very close relatives to the actual moment where he might be seen to do this. And his nephew was there, and his nephew has a letter that Macartney's asked him to lie about something and he feels uncomfortable about it. So that suggests that Macartney actually did something that he didn't want people back in Britain to know about. And if you look at George Thomas Staunton's diary, and he's an 11-year-old, he wrote, "We knelt down and performed the ceremony," and then he crossed it out. So it looks like in his diary, his father was telling him how to describe what they'd done. So those have been very big issues, and they had to be negotiated. Li Zibiao, obviously, when he was there, they managed a kind of compromise situation. But when the next British embassy comes back in 1816 and George Thomas is interpreting, he's in a really different situation because George Thomas, his friends have been getting into trouble. So the British are sending naval ships to the south coast of China to attack freight shipping. This is it during the Napoleonic Wars, and the ships coming out with tea from the port of Canton or Guangzhou are very, very valuable prizes. So all these merchant British naval ships are skulking off the coast trying to attack French ships. And obviously the Chinese state does not like this. I mean, they wouldn't like it now and they didn't like it then. And one of the things that they try to do is to control the people who are dealing too closely, they feel, with the British. And George Thomas Staunton's friends, who are also people who are in that intermediary interpreter role, they get into really big trouble. And one of his friends is put in a kind of stocks, a kind of Chinese version of the stocks, outside the factories. So that's the building where the British have their offices for a prolonged period. And then he gets sent into exile in Xinjiang, up in China's far west, you know, a really terrifying outcome. And then another friend of Staunton's gets imprisoned and sent into exile. So a young man, very much the same age as him, who's one of his really close friends. And we've got all the young, that young Chinese man's letters from prison still survive in the Foreign Office archive. Just amazing, telling Staunton what to say, how to negotiate his case. But the Chinese emperor, by this time we're on the Jiaqing emperor, the son of Qianlong, he becomes aware that Staunton's involved. And he actually sends out an edict, so a proper imperial statement condemning Staunton and saying that if he puts a foot wrong, he should be sent into exile. He should not be sent back to his own country. And it happens just before that next embassy to China, and Staunton goes on it. And the ambassador at that stage is Lord Amherst, and Amherst doesn't know about this. Staunton doesn't tell him. But all the Qing officials they meet are trying to use this fact to bully Staunton into making sure that Amherst does kowtow and perform these rituals. They basically, it becomes a very huge issue. And Staunton feels that if he were to kowtow or to promote that kowtow, would look like he was a total coward. And eventually he has to tell Amherst both that Macartney actually did this maneuver, or at least that what he says is Macartney went down on one knee and bowed his head to the ground 9 times. But actually, I mean, there's very little you can tell if you're wearing long robes between down on one knee and down on 2 knees once you're bowing your head to the ground 9 times. And Lord Amherst thinks that's just basically the same thing. And he thinks he's willing to do it. He thinks, who cares what the Chinese is? This is ridiculous. Uncivilized peoples with uncivilized trade by this stage, their attitude, the British attitude towards the Chinese declines massively in this period when they take control of India and they start thinking of Asians and Asiatics in very strongly negative light. Whereas in the late 18th century, they're still seeing them very much in the eyes of the Jesuits who'd been there as missionaries, who promoted China as a kind of model for Europe with this wonderful benevolent monarchy and ruled by philosopher kings. And there's this whole sort of positive attitude. And that really collapses around the turn of the 19th century as you go into the 19th century. So Amherst doesn't care. He's prepared to kowtow. Who cares? But Staunton says, absolutely no, that would be awful. We really mustn't do that. And that embassy collapses. They get taken to the court where the British say they're looked at, treated like animals in a zoo. Everyone comes and looks at them and kind of pokes them, and they're not treated respectfully at all. And at that point, Amherst refuses to meet the emperor because he feels disrespected. They get sent immediately back to the coast.
And what can you tell us about the afterlife, as it were, of Li? Because he also got into hot water, didn't he?
So after the embassy, Li goes off to be a missionary in Shanxi province, in a rural area. But mostly he lives in a quite comfortable life. When you say he's a missionary, he's basically a priest of a huge area. The area he was priest of is about the size of Norway, so, with about 300 small congregations. And he was the only clergy person there. So it puts some British clergy who complain about large parishes in perspective. But as the Jiaqing emperor becomes more hostile to the Europeans, and also because there have been religious rebellions in China set off by Buddhist sectarian groups, the Chinese state becomes very concerned on cracking down on religious groups. They feel that they're a danger, and that includes Catholics, who to them look just basically like the Buddhist sectarians. They don't distinguish very firmly. And so Li is living in this world, and he ends up having to go into hiding. So he's got this amazing education, but he actually ends up living his life, the end of his life, in hiding in this tiny, tiny little village. And that village remains as an entirely Catholic village, but it's way up in the mountains. And the Chinese had all this amazing knowledge. And he was very loyal to the Chinese government. He was actually very moved by his relationship with the Qianlong Emperor. He never criticizes the Chinese government in his letters. Even when they're persecuting Christians and sending his flock into exile in Xinjiang, he never criticizes them. but they're wasting all this knowledge. So there's all this knowledge about the West, because China at that point is fantastically ill-informed. You know, at the point of when they're about to go to war with Britain, they're actually writing, you know, the British won't be good at fighting on land because their knees don't bend properly. You know, and that's just an insane sort of mistake to be making after 200 years of having the British present. You know, you must have known that their knees bent. But the formal state apparatus is really poorly informed. And one of the things I want to show people in this book is how part of the reason for that is that the people who know this stuff, people like Li Zibiao, people like George Thomas Staunton and his friends, his Chinese friends, really don't dare to speak out.
Finally, what do you think that looking at these two interpreters can tell us about the changing relationship between China and Britain over this period that you look at?
So for a long time, we had an idea that China was isolated from the West and didn't know about it because Chinese people despised Westerners and their learning, and that the Opium War was the result of China's refusal to engage in diplomacy with the West after the McCartney embassy. However, I think when we look at the interpreters, we see that there's actually much more contact than we realized. One of the most fun people I discovered this project was a chap called John Ho Chi. And John Ho Chi was originally a Chinese guy called He Zhi, who had to flee from China in the 1810s. And he settled in Sussex, where he became a gentleman farmer. Married an English woman, Charlotte Mole, sent his son to Edinburgh University to study medicine. His daughters mostly married doctors. And there were some Ho Chi almshouses still exist in Sussex, donated by his wife after she was called Charlotte Mole after his death. And I think that whole world of interconnections has been much downplayed. And I think one of the things we need to think about as China's relations is that China wasn't totally isolated, but quite often the problem was that the central state decision-making body wasn't necessarily as well as informed as it could have been. And one of the reasons for this is the fear of those people who are in between.
That was Henrietta Harrison. Her book, The Perils of Interpreting, is published by Princeton and has recently been shortlisted for the Kundal History Prize. We'll be speaking to all of the shortlisted authors in the next few weeks, so you can look forward to finding those episodes in your podcast feeds. And you can find out more about the Kundal History Prize at kundalprize.com. That's C-U-N-D-I-L-L. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.